Well, hey everybody, whether you're here in the room or joining us online, it is great to be with you. Now, before we go any farther, we really need to acknowledge something of absolutely historic significance. And as is so often the case, a picture is worth a thousand words. So just check out this picture with me. Now that is what I'm talking about. And of course, I also wanted to share a rather savage tweet from the Michigan State Police Metro Detroit unit that I saw reported on Facebook. So to be fair, it may have been a fake, but here's what it said. Those leaving Ann Arbor, please drive safely and celebrate. If you happen to be heading to the state down south, you can really take your time. Your season is over. Oh, now, that's not nice, okay? It's funny. But it's not nice, and honestly, as I was walking out of the big house with my two eldest and my wife, I began to have anxiety over next year in Columbus, just being honest. Anyway, as many of you know, we are in the final week of a series called Seven, in which we're exploring seven letters that were originally addressed to churches located in seven cities near the west coast of modern-day Turkey, and those letters were recorded for us in the last book in the Bible, a document called Revelation, that as we've noted, can be a bit challenging to read. And so in this series, what I'm trying to do is show you what I believe the first people who received that letter would have seen, and then talk about what it might mean for us today. So, all right, now that said, we get to spend this morning exploring the last of those seven letters, the one originally intended for Christians living in an ancient city called Laodicea. And once again this week, to get us going, I want to show you a brief 30-second video just to give you a sense of what the site looks like of Laodicea should you pay it a visit. So let's check this out. So as you undoubtedly noticed, Laodicea is one of the most excavated archaeological sites in all of Turkey, and that's saying something. There is an archaeological site around every corner in Turkey. And that actually makes sense because Laodicea was one of the most significant ancient cities in all of Turkey. In fact, it's the only Roman city I'm aware of that has not one but two theaters. Laodicea was situated on a major east-west highway that ran all the way to the harbor city of Ephesus on the coast of the Aegean Sea. And it's important for us to know that the highway ran through Laodicea and not simply by Laodicea. In other words, as the highway passed through the town, it became Main Street, kind of like Fulton does when you travel through downtown Lowell. Shout out to my Red Arrow people. Where you at? Yes. Anyway, because of this reality, Laodicea became a major hub for trade. It was a center for banking and the home of a major medical school where a popular eye treatment had been developed that was utilized all over the Roman Empire. And additionally, the city was known for the production of a black, glossy wool that was used to make distinctive high-end tunics that were, again, exported all over the Roman Empire. The city was famous, and the city was incredibly prosperous and self-sufficient. So if you had said to people in the ancient world, what is it like? What are people in Laodicea like? They would say, well, I mean, it's prosperous. It's one of the richest cities in our area, and it's also self-sufficient. In fact, historians record that around 60 AD, there was a massive earthquake that decimated the city. And when the Roman emperor, or the empire rather, offered funds to help the city rebuild, the city's leaders met and they refused to accept the help. They sent a message back to Rome that basically said, you know what, we'll take care of it ourselves. Well, like I said, prosperous and self-sufficient. Okay, so now with just that bit of background, let's jump into the message Jesus sends to Christians living in Laodicea. He begins with these words. He says to them, I know your deeds, that you are neither hot or neither cold nor hot. He says, I wish you were either one or the other. So, he says, because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth, which is a little unpleasant. So let me tell you what Jesus is after here. He basically says, listen, I see you. I've been watching you. And your faith is not being demonstrated in your life as much as it could or should or maybe even was in the past. I found your practice of faith and consequently your cultural impact, the difference you're making in your city, lacking. Now there's also a bit of additional context that's helpful in understanding what Jesus is saying here. And actually, I learned about it this past August when my wife, Sarah Ann, and I were in Turkey visiting Laodicea. And the cultural piece of evidence goes like this. Laodicea was located in a valley near two other ancient cities, Hierapolis and Colossae. And the Colossae is originally the church that received the letter we call Colossians that made its way into the New Testament of the Bible. In ancient times, the Tri-City area then, so Laodicea, Hierapolis, and Colossae, were notable for their water and for different reasons. Hierapolis lies some 6 miles to the north of Laodicea, and it has long been famous for its hot mineral springs. Even today, people visit the region to seek relief from all sorts of aches and pains in the waters. Now, the second city, Colossae, was about 10 miles to the east of Laodicea, and it was situated at the foot of a snow-capped mountain from which ice-cold mountain streams would flow. So that's Hierapolis and Laodicea. And you say, well, what was the water like, or Hierapolis and Colossae, rather, what was the water like in Laodicea? Well, Laodicea wasn't built very near a water source, and so they had to pipe their water in from 5 miles away through a series of Roman aqueducts, and upon reaching the city, the water would flow to a massive fountain near the center of town. Here's an artist's reconstruction of that fountain. Again, big, prosperous town, big, impressive fountain, and this is where everybody would go to get their drinking water. But by many, many accounts, the point where the water reached the fountain, it was lukewarm and tasted nasty. In fact, historians record that Laodicea was widely recognized for its horrible, tepid drinking water. So now, 2,000 years later, you can sort of get a sense of what a big deal this is, especially if you've ever been to America's favorite drug dealer. And of course, I mean Starbucks, right? Yeah. I mean, think about it. Whenever you approach the counter, not you people that order through the app, but you actually go talk to the human, right? And you order a latte, your friendly neighborhood barista always asks you the same three-word question. Do they not? It goes, hot or iced, right? Hot or iced, hot or cold. And depending on your mood and the season of the year, both can be a good option, right? I mean, a hot latte can be soothing. An iced latte can be refreshing. Both can be incredible. Both have a purpose. But have you ever noticed that no self-respecting barista has ever asked you if you wanted your latte lukewarm, right? I mean, nobody ever says, hey, we made this mocha for a guy like an hour and a half ago, and it's like been sitting on the counter, but I'm pretty sure it hasn't curdled yet, so would you like it, right? Like, nobody wants to drink that. And that's kind of what Jesus is after when he's talking about neither being hot nor cold, and so he wants to sort of spit them out. It's like he's saying, listen, as a church, you're lukewarm. You become lukewarm in the practice of your faith. You're not hot, bringing comfort to those who are suffering, and you're not like a cold, refreshing presence to people in need. You're not doing what you know you should be doing. Your faith, as evidenced by your lack of deeds, is tepid. And so Jesus says to them, I wish you were one or the other, like both for your sake and for the sake of the community who needs to know the truth of who I am and what I have accomplished. Now, to be honest, I read this description and I find myself reflecting once again on something that sort of haunts me. I revisit the thought every so often. And the thought is this, I mean, what if the greatest threat to the mission and the message of Jesus in our world has always been lukewarm Christianity, and not the other suspects that sometimes get viewed as threats to Christianity, things like, you know, aggressive atheism or militant Islam or secular relativism or a media that often seems largely opposed to people of faith, or at least the pictures they present of people of faith. Like, these are the usual suspects, but what if the greatest apologetic against the truth of the Christian faith is Christians who acknowledge their faith in Jesus with their lips but deny him by their lifestyle when they just don't look any different than anyone else? I mean, if the way of Jesus is supposed to spread from life to life, and if the way of Jesus is a way of life that is to be learned through a process called discipleship, and discipleship takes modeling, then it's actually pretty easy to see that lukewarm Christianity is absolutely toxic to the mission and message of Jesus advancing in our world. And I think that's why Jesus effectively says to this church at Laodicea, listen, I didn't give up my life so that you could pursue a self-focused and all too often apathetic faith. Like, if you want to experience the life I have for you, then living out your faith in deeds that make this world more like I want it to be must be a priority. Now, it's interesting to me that Laodicea is the only one of the seven churches addressed in Revelation that's given no affirmation whatsoever from Jesus. They don't seem to have been threatened by persecution or poverty or false teachers that the other churches in the region seem to be challenged by it. Somehow, they seem to have only been threatened by themselves, which sort of makes me wonder, like, what happened? Like, what makes this town and its followers so unique? What in their culture caused them to drift towards an apathetic practice of their faith? And we actually know because of what Jesus says next. He tells them this. He says, you say I am rich. I have acquired wealth and do not need a thing. So, like, apparently the prosperity and the corresponding notion of self-sufficiency and independence that characterized the town of Laodicea had made its way into the church of Laodicea. That they had actually reached the point where they had become convinced that they really didn't need anything from anyone, including God. And then I'm certain that none of them would have, like, verbalized that understanding. It's one of those things that would have been true at the level of their hearts. But because Jesus sees their hearts, he confronts them directly because he loves them and he knows they've fallen away from their mission in the world. He wants to alert them to the spiritual toxicity of their present reality because I don't think they were aware of how dangerous it was. And so after affirming that he knows that they believe they're without need, he says to them, but you do not realize that you were wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. In other words, guys, it's almost like Jesus is coaching them. He says, guys, you're materially wealthy, but you're spiritually bankrupt. And those are tough words, especially coming from Jesus. But that was their unvarnished reality. And I suspect that if, like, we were honest, they're words that many of us may need to hear this morning as well. This has been working on me all week long. So for a few minutes, we need to talk about wealth because I know what some of you are thinking. You're thinking, you know, I'm so glad that we're finally going to talk to those wealthy people. I mean, they need a good talking to from time to time. But here's the weird thing. Like, if you're listening to the sound of my voice, whether here or online, assuming you're not in a third world country, and if you are, welcome. Glad to have you along, right? But by the world standards, if you're listening to the sound of my voice, you should know that you are wealthy. And so am I. Like, seriously, if you own a car and can read and have access to education, you're wealthy. In fact, you're, like, wealthier than most of the people in the world will ever be. And so when we hear Jesus say to Christians in Laodicea, you say, I am rich, I don't want you to think about people in our world who you think are rich. I want you to think about yourself. I want you to think about you. I want you to think about me. Because I'm telling you, there's something about wealth and literacy and education and the ability to travel that can quickly lead us to think, you know what? I can do this on my own. I can make this happen. And that can inadvertently bring us to the place where we start to think that, well, honestly, we really don't need God either. That's how material prosperity can lead to spiritual bankruptcy. And that's actually something, as I've been reflecting on it this week, that's been true for, like, as long as there have been people. And I point to as evidence, you know, 1,500 years before the time of Jesus, around 3,500 years ago, There was a man named Moses. You may remember him from the Ten Commandments movie with Charlton Heston, right? But a man named Moses warned the children of Israel of the connection between material prosperity and spiritual bankruptcy shortly before they crossed into the land God had promised to give their ancestor Abraham. And after affirming to these people that the land into which they're being led would produce everything they need, it's a land flowing with milk and honey. It's a picture of blessing. It's a picture of richness. They're going to get not only what they need to survive, but what they need to thrive. As they're about to enter the land, Moses says to them, "When you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land he's given you." He goes on, "Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, his laws, and his decrees that I'm giving to you this day. Otherwise," he says, "when you eat and are satisfied, when you build fine houses and settle down, and when your herds and flocks grow large, and your silver and gold increase, and all that you have is multiplied, then," here's the deal, "your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God. You may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me." He says, but you've got to remember, it's the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. In other words, Moses says to the children of Israel, listen, you've got to remember that it's God who gives you your hands and your eyes and everything you need to earn a living. And once again, I know what a few of us are thinking, something like, okay, I get that, but isn't it also true that I did the work that led me to where I am today? And that is certainly true. It is our choice to work hard and to capitalize on the opportunities that present themselves to us. But it's not our choice where on the planet and when in human history we are born. That is God's choice. And so consequently, you have to admit that there are some levels of prosperity for which we just can't take credit. I mean, if one of us had been born in the slums of Kibera outside of Nairobi, Kenya, or as a member of the lowest class in India, we simply wouldn't have the opportunities that we have been presented with. And so it's easy to understand why Moses says what he says. There's this natural tendency when blessed with opportunity and material success in this life to forget about God. And so he instructs the people. He says, listen, when you're blessed, respond with humility and give thanks to God. Because, and this is one of our key ideas today, material prosperity sometimes results in spiritual bankruptcy. Material prosperity sometimes results in spiritual bankruptcy. And then, and this isn't the only place this idea shows up. In fact, there's another spot in the Old Testament, in that collection of literature, in a collection of ancient literature called Proverbs. And the author in the proverb I want to show you records like an honest prayer that reflects like a profound understanding of the human heart. And it's a prayer that, honestly, when you see it, most of us would not want to pray. But here's what he writes. He says, "God, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread." And the daily bread, that's a reference to Israel's time in the wilderness after being rescued from slavery in Egypt, where every day God provided manna from heaven for them. It was sort of a cornflake substance, and every day they would gather just what they needed for that day. And God said, hey, if you take more than you need for that day, maggots are going to eat it, so it's going to be a fool's errand. So just get what you need for the day. And God was trying to teach them to rely on him day by day. If they were going to be his people in the world, reflecting his character to the world, then they had to trust him. And he says, this is how we're going to do it, one day at a time. And so this proverb is written from a place of prosperity. Say, God, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me my daily bread. Give me only as much as I need for today, and then give me what I need for the next day. And then as he continues to write, he tells us why that's such a big deal. He says, otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Like, I'll forget about you. Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. Like, the author here reveals a stunning level of self-awareness. Like, he knows that if he doesn't have what he needs, he's more likely to steal than to starve. And he knows that if he experiences like material successes, there's a high likelihood he'll feel as though he doesn't need God. Like Moses said before him, he's well aware that material prosperity sometimes leads to spiritual bankruptcy. And so he asked God to give him just what he needs, one day at a time, one step at a time. And so again, it's this repeated theme in the story of ancient Israel. And it shows up here in this message to Christians living in Laodicea when Jesus confronts them on something that at some level they must have already been feeling. They were undeniably materially successful and undeniably spiritually unproductive. And I bet like in an honest moment, many of them would confess that they were unsatisfied with their faith. Well, fortunately, as Jesus continues, he gives them some advice that seems a little strange, at least at first. Let me show you what he says, and then I'll tell you what I think he's getting after. He says, okay, so this is your present reality. You've experienced material prosperity and spiritual bankruptcy. Here's what I want you to do. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so that you can become rich, and white clothes to wear so that you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes so you can see. And that's a really interesting thing to say to a church in a town that's famous for its banking, its high-end clothing, and its eye salve. It's almost like Jesus says to them, I want you to come to me for your spiritual wealth and spiritual clothing and treatment for your spiritual blindness so that you can see things as they really are. And Jesus concludes his message to them with an invitation. And I love this because this is one of the things you see over and over and over again when you read Jesus' teachings and his words to people like us in the ancient world. He says to them, I want to invite you from where you are to move forward. Like, I'm not going to give up on you. I'm not done with you. Your failure is not final, but I want to invite you to try again. Here's what Jesus says. He says, those whom I love, I rebuke and discipline. So be earnest and repent. That means to return. Return to the path that I've instructed you to walk. He says, here I am. This is beautiful. I stand at the door and knock. He says, if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come in and eat with him and he with me. Like in the ancient world, dining together was a sign of friendship. It was a sign of community. And so Jesus says, listen, I'm not bringing this correction to you because I hate you or I'm done with you. I'm bringing this correction to you because I love you and I desire to use you in and use your lives. In fact, I'm ready and waiting to partner with you to bring the good news of what I've accomplished to your world in real and tangible ways, not just the ideas, but the demonstrated love and self-sacrifice. I'm ready for you to bring comfort to and peace to hurting people as you live out your faith. I'm ready for you to get hot or cold or hot and cold. I'm not done with you, but I am calling you to get off the bench and get back into the game because the world needs to know the truth of what I've accomplished, and the world needs to feel my love in tangible ways through you. This has been the plan from the beginning, but you have forgotten. All right, now before we come in for a landing, we need to talk a little bit about you and me, because there's nothing here for us, as you can probably already guess, right? And what I want to do is start by revisiting a question that we asked earlier today. What if the greatest danger to Christianity is lukewarm Christianity? And if you'll allow me to make it a little more personal, what if the greatest danger to Christianity and the message and mission of Jesus in our world today is our lukewarm faith? And what if our faith that may have started out red hot or ice cold has slowly, maybe even imperceptibly mellowed due to our material successes? And what if Jesus is standing at the door to our hearts and repeatedly knocking and repeatedly inviting us to repent and to reengage with the mission that he has for our lives? I can't help but wonder if there's a few of us that have that sense right now. Maybe we've had it for a while, but we've been too distracted by like the 24/7 noise of the news cycle and social media and all of our streaming services. It's like we haven't had any time to pay attention. And if that's you, if you have that sense, I just need to ask you a question. Like, how long will you leave Jesus standing there? How long will it be before you answer the door and invite him in? Because I'm telling you, when you do, that's when your life begins to turn from black and white to color. That's what it looks like to really live as a follower of Jesus. So what might it look like for you to re-engage your faith as a mission to be light in a dark world? I think it probably begins with an affirmation of and a rededication to making a difference with the lives that we're given. A commitment to like be light and bring the light into areas of darkness in our circle of influence. To offer something to Jesus that the authors of the Bible call our hearts. That's that like emotional center, the place from which we live and love and long. Well, what I want to do is, as we kind of come in for a landing today, is give you a little bit of time. We're not only landing a talk today, but we're also landing a series of talks. And we've covered a lot of ground, and there's been a lot of challenge, and you know, a bunch of you have emailed me saying, wow, I felt like you were talking just to me, and I was like, yes, it was just you. I'm just kidding, right? Yeah. But I mean, there's a whole bunch going on here, but just that idea that Jesus is standing at the door of your heart and knocking, and what would it be like to open it up and to welcome him inside and to recommit yourself to making a difference with your life, to open yourself up, because there's something about our world that closes us in on ourselves and encourages us to like think about number one, like that's us, only us. And it's like Jesus invites us to open up and say, what might you do with your one precious life? And so I want to listen to a song with you together as a chance to give you some space to maybe say a simple prayer. An ancient prayer posture is just to open your palms up to God, to say, God, this is what I have, and I offer it to you. And just use me, awaken me to the opportunities that surround me. And so as we gather, just has your faith faded into the background of your life? Have other things, even good things, quietly but undeniably pushed Jesus from the center of your life? Or has your material prosperity distracted you from your mission and calling? And again, if so, consider that Jesus is inviting you to get off the bench and back into the game. There are people to love and people who've never heard the reality of the hope of what Jesus can do in a life. People that God wants to use you to meet. I'm telling you, there's no greater joy in this life than experiencing what can happen when you partner with God to bring needed change to the world. So just